is a very a deceptively simple little scene, but there's a lot of richness in it. It's chapter 8, verse 14, and we read, "When Jesus entered Peter's house," some of you might have been to Capernaum and seen Peter's house. That's what it is. So physically, it's somehow nice to see the spot. There'd be no way of doubting that's Peter's house that's there, or the ground of it. "When Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand," here we have touch again, "and the fever left her. And she got up," you could hardly imagine a simpler word than get up, but I'm about to make it complicated for you. "She got up and began to serve them." End of story. Two critical words. Got up, Greek egeiro, is the word used all the time in the New Testament for the resurrection. The key word. There are other words used, but that's the key word. So egeiro, literally it means to arouse or to awaken someone from sleep. It comes to mean rouse someone, like they're sitting down and they stand up and get moving. Simple word in Greek, no great complexity to it. But it is used, therefore, for people who are roused from the sleep of death. Get the imagery? And they go on to life. And it's used of the word for Jesus being raised from the dead. So this, when this woman gets up, she's actually raised. And there's a play on a word that's going to see all the depths and meaning of people being raised to life. Why is she raised to life? Because God loves her. But the effect of her being raised is put them in it. She begin to serve them. Okay, you can put that at its most simple meaning. She started to make scones and cakes and cups of tea and generally look after them, in which case you end up with a rather humorous story in a way. I don't want it to be that. Jesus comes in a typically male chauvinist fashion. He wants to be looked after, and the woman's sick, so he cures her. Pretty sensible, but it isn't the point of this passage. When you are unable to serve, it's hard, isn't it? We're all made to serve. We talked about earlier, we're made to love, we're made to give. We want to give. And sometimes we can't give because someone won't accept it or we're not able to or whatever. And that's a very painful thing for a parent, I'm sure. You want to love your child and they won't listen. Or you want to love your husband and he's never there. Or you want to love your wife and she's off with the feminists or whatever's going on. You can't kind of, it's not working. And that's very painful because we're made to give love and receive it. Well, this woman is healed so that she can serve. What does serve mean at its deepest level? The verb used for serve in Greek, I've written it therefore in English lettering, diakoneo, if you listen to the sound diakon, diakon, deacon, it means to minister, and we get our word deacon from it, which is the ancient scriptural word for that ministry in the church. But it has a more precise meaning. Serve does not primarily mean serve the person who's in need. It can involve that, but that's not its critical meaning. Its meaning is to serve God. The servant of the Lord, the servant of Yahweh. In classical Greek, though it doesn't occur very often, this word is used only in religious texts. In the non-Christian and non-Jewish Greek, it's serving at a ritual banquet, not any banquet. It doesn't mean just serving at table, though Kittel in his famous 10-volume work says that. He's been proved to be wrong. The experts can be wrong. And on this he was wrong. A more thorough look at the word finds it's serving, ministering in a sacred setting for the gods. Doing God's will. Ministering to the orders given by the divinity. She is serving God. In serving God, since God is love, that will often be expressed by serving other people, but it may be expressed by not serving them. It'll depend on God's will, won't it? If I come along and serve you when it's not God's will, I'm not serving. Do you get me? I'm trying to fulfill my need to feel good, but I'm not doing God's will. So I'm not loving, actually, either. I'm just doing things because I don't like doing nothing, or because I want to appear good, or because I feel good when I'm helping other people. They're not bad things, but they may not be good things either, and they need watching, don't they? So serving always means, in the scriptures, doing the will of God, listening to God, and being a vehicle of God's love to other people. Well, that's what this woman is. Little play on that word just for one more moment. This is a text from St. Paul, which is a beautiful text, 1 Corinthians 12, 4-7, and I've just created that little picture out of it. I'll read the text first, and the diagram may or may not help you. Paul says, there are varieties of gifts, the Greek charism. There are varieties of gifts, but there's only one Spirit. To change the image, there's a variety of instruments, but there's only the one breath. You can blow into a trombone or you can blow into a piccolo. They'll sound very different, but it's the one breath. So God is the only breath, the breath of life, and he breathes through all these musical instruments here, and all of you sound different when God plays through you. All your ways of loving are unique, but they're all beautiful and they all make up the harmony of creation, the music of the spheres, to take Shakespeare's expression. So we all contribute to the music of the spheres, to the harmony of creation. There are varieties of charisms, but only one breath. There are varieties of ministries. Here's the noun, diakonia. But there's only one Lord, one Master, one who says what to do and when to do it, and who is the one of whom we are serving, the Lord. And thirdly, there are varieties of, how you translate into English I don't know, but the Greek is energema, and I've put it there for you to see if you've got, the R is a P in Greek, but energy, energema, means ways of energizing, ways of bringing things to be, creative energy. There are varieties of ways of creating, but there's only one God who inspires all of them in everybody. To each person is given that manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Hence the diagram. On the right-hand side, the Spirit, that gift of the Spirit that each of us has. On the left-hand lower corner, the Lord or the Son, the ministries that we have from him, doing his will, carrying out his mission, carrying on from that passion he had for love and service and so on. And there's only one God, the Father, who makes all our ministries, all our Spirit-inspired ministries, effective, because God is the only creator. And so what happens when you minister to the Lord with the Spirit is God's will, and it's creative. Anything else is just fill in or clutter or distraction. And as the Father and Son and Spirit are one in a spiral of love, bound in unity, so it is the very being that each of us is. You are, from one aspect, you are a gift of the Spirit to everybody around you. From another aspect, you are one entrusted with a mission from the Son, from the Lord. And from another aspect, you are a way of God creating through your love when you are in accordance with God's will. So it's Trinitarian, it's communitarian, it's all for the common good, binding everyone into the Trinity. Well, that massive theology, massive is a fairly ugly word for it, I suppose, that intricate theology of Paul about the church and the community and about our integrating our whole life with the energy of God's powerful Spirit is actually all in that little tiny text we looked at. This woman is healed so she can do God's will now. She can serve, minister with the Spirit of Jesus and with the power of God. She's the first person in the gospel who is called a minister. You can see she's a woman, so don't like forget that. Whatever the church tells you about ministry and all that, don't let's forget these wonderful truths. Ones will do tonight. We now come to two critical questions. Matthew stops the action, just those three typical, symbolic, powerful scenes of leper, centurion, and mother-in-law. And he asks a question about Jesus. Who is he? Who is this Jesus? And he gives two connected and fundamental and beautiful answers. Here's the first one, and this is typical of Matthew. It's only in Matthew. That evening, they brought to him many who were possessed with demons. Possessed with demons, I'm not quite sure what that means. I don't know that we can be sure what it means, because I mean by sure, clear in the mind. Because once you get into the demonic, you are into the irrational, you're into the unexplainable, you're into the unintelligible. The demonic is essentially irrational and unexplainable, so you can't explain it. So it's not as if you don't know enough to explain it, it just is absurd. It's like evil. Evil cannot be explained. It's not matter for intelligible understanding. It can't be seen, because we can only see what is seeable and reasonable, and our mind can make sense of it. You can't make sense of evil. You can't make sense of the demonic. So you're necessarily in black mystery, not the light mystery of the Trinity, but the black mystery of the black hole that you can't fathom or even comprehend. But so there's evil here. Whatever we mean by evil, and we're struggling to understand it, and we can struggle on the outside, but we ought to know we'll never get there. So there were many people who were caught up in all kinds of evil situations which are bigger than them, bigger than what we can define, and we take it into the whole demonic and leave it there, or just call people out of it and without understanding it. And he cast out spirits with a word. Spirits, I don't know what spirits are in the scriptural sense. I think they could well equal virus in modern English. Like, don't be too, their medical knowledge was primitive, and actually so is ours, isn't it? I'm sorry, there are doctors in the house, but when somebody says you've got a virus, are they telling you much more than this? I mean, it's such a vague word. I often think when a doctor tells me I've got a virus, it means he doesn't know or she doesn't know what I've got. And that's fair enough, because you can't know everything. But so spirit is a word for the spirit, the discernment of spirits. Something's going wrong in the person, and it seems to be to do with the psyche or the mind or the feelings. Or anyhow, Jesus could heal, that's the point. Whatever he healed from, he could bring people into a sensible, beautiful, peaceful place where it was gone. And he cured those who were sick. And by sick, they just mean sick physically. They could, something you can understand, got a broken leg or a whatever. So he's a healing person, has the gift of healing, obviously to a stunning degree. And I don't, that doesn't surprise me. People heal today, don't they? Healing's going on all over our world. Some people have the gift of healing in their hands, in their, some people like Mozart can tell quarter turns, I can't. But some people have an exceptional ability, don't they, to hear music. Some have like a Van Gogh, have an incredible ability to see light that I can't see. They've just got this genius. Some people have the ability to heal. Well, you know that. And it's a natural gift. It's part of the chemistry of being a human being. Some people abuse that natural gift and use it for charlatan behaviour, use it to make money, but they still got it. But they can use it for all kinds of self-centred purposes. And that's really dangerous. Some use it only, like Jesus, only in love and only to draw people to be free from him, like free to be. He didn't create dependency through it, and he didn't use it to make a magician of himself, but he does seem clearly to have had this wonderful gift of healing. I wonder if in his case it's actually just an overflow of love. Because love heals, doesn't it? I mean, you've been in situations where you've been in a terrible place and someone has loved you, and we know how healing that is. So if you love like Jesus, why wouldn't it heal enormously? And that's what he's doing. Now, Matthew. Simple verse. This was to fulfill what has been spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took our infirmities and he bore our diseases. That's the end of Matthew's little statement. But oh, it's rich. That verse comes from Isaiah chapter 53, verse 4. I'm going to read it all to you in a minute, just for your meditation, so you can hear it. It comes from, you may have heard of the songs of the servant of Yahweh. I don't know if you have or haven't, but the servant of the Lord, the servant of Yahweh. The songs of the servant, there are four of them in the second book of Isaiah. That is that book in the Isaiah scroll that comes from the period of the exile, written by that anonymous prophet who, as Cyrus of Persia was getting nearer and nearer to Babylon, was filled with immense hope that his people would go back to Jerusalem. And as he's preparing the people, this unknown anonymous person, as he's preparing the people to get ready to go back, because some of them probably were reluctant to go back and all that, he's writing about what kind of Moses figure they needed. What kind of leadership do we need? We saw what the kings were like. They were hopeless, basically. We'll need a spiritual leader like Moses. And so the paradigm or the model for this song is Moses. He's the one he's got in mind. And he writes about Moses, really. But he writes very beautifully about this leader who will have to take us back. The kind of qualities we'll want in him. And they are the lovely, lovely songs of the servant of Yahweh. The fourth of them we read every first Friday because it's so fitting for Jesus. Let me read it, and it includes that verse. And when the New Testament people went back to the Old Testament to try to find poetry, music, images that fitted Jesus, this is their favourite text. This is quoted and alluded to 40 times or something in the New Testament. It's the most engaging poetry that picks up the feeling of Jesus for his contemporaries. So let me read it to you. It starts. It won't all apply equally to Jesus. Of course, it's not written about him. It's written about the kind of leader that they'll need who will be humble, faithful, meek, strong, be able to cope with suffering, all of that. But gee, it applies to Jesus beautifully. Starts, see my servant, this is God speaking, my servant, we've just seen the word service, the servant of Yahweh, my servant shall prosper. He shall be exalted, lifted up, and be very high. That's the promise, that's the first line. Just as there were many who were astonished at him, so marred was his appearance beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of mortals. People looked at him and they thought, ooh. They were revolted by what they saw. They weren't attracted by what they saw. But as they were startled by this leper, this broken man, so he shall startle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them they shall see, and that which they had not heard they shall contemplate. Who has believed what we've heard? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Stunning stuff. And here it is. He grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we'd look on him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by others. He was a man of suffering, acquainted with infirmity. He was like one from whom others hide their faces. He was despised, and we treated him as of no account. Surely, here's our text, he has borne our infirmities and carried our diseases. Yet we accounted him stricken, struck down by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, we've all turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he didn't open his mouth. Like a lamb led to the slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, he did not open his mouth. By a perversion of justice, he was taken away. Who could have imagined his future? He was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people. They made his grave with the wicked and his tomb with the rich, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him with pain. When you make his life an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring and shall prolong his days. Through him the will of the Lord shall prosper. Out of his anguish he shall see light. He shall find satisfaction through his knowledge. The righteous one, my servant, shall make many righteous. He shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will allot him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured himself out to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many and made intercession for sinners. The whole of that song, poem, image of a strange person who led a humble, broken, not a great military leader, but someone who could bear pain, was going to lead them, a humble people, back to their land. Someone like Moses, who's called in the book of Numbers the humblest of men. Someone who could bear the weight of the people who want to go back to Egypt and says, Lord, I can't bear it any longer, but he stands there and prays for them, even though they don't know what the heck they're doing. A leader who could bear all this humanity and still keep faith. Well, that's who Jesus is. This one who's holding the leper, and he'll get into a lot of trouble for that, reaching out to Gentiles, and he'll get into a lot of trouble for that, facing evil and sin and suffering and calling people out to serve who aren't among the ministerial community, like a mother-in-law, not one of the clerics of the day. The one who's doing all this loving is going to end up where the suffering servant was because of what he did. But that's who we're watching here. the one who took our infirmities and bore our diseases. Some of that text I've put there for you again. He's like the leper in being rejected. He's an outsider like the centurion, and he too is raised up like the woman we just met. Secondly, and these two are meant to be linked, we're really asking, who is Jesus? We're getting our first theology. We're getting our first understanding of who is this one. And Matthew's first one is suffering servant. So get that clear first, he says, that he is the servant who suffers. If you don't understand that, you'll never understand Jesus. Now he takes us another step of theology, which is intimately connected in verse 8, chapter 8, verse 18 to 22, and we'll finish with this scene. When Jesus saw great crowds around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. A scribe then approached. Scribe means a scripture scholar, if you like, someone who studies the law, the Torah. A scribe approached and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Beautiful. Very impressed with Jesus. And here's Jesus' response. Doesn't deny him, doesn't reject him. Jesus said, "Foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests. But the Son of Man," here's Jesus' self-identity, "the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." We'll come back to that. Foxes have holes, could be Herod the fox, could be about Herod and the Herodians. Like, scribe, if you want to follow me and you want power, you want to be with the leaders of the community, don't bother. Foxes have holes. The birds of the air may be an allusion to the Roman eagle on the standard. So following Jesus, you won't be with the winners. You won't be with those who march through the land with heavy boots. You won't be with the conquerors and the mighty and so on. You won't belong to the power block. If you follow me, you'll be following the Son of Man, and we have to look at that in a minute. And he has nowhere to lay his head. Another of his disciples, now here's a different, this is not just an outside scribe who's fascinated and needs to be warned that if he follows Jesus, he's going to follow the Son of Man, which we'll look at in a moment. This is a disciple, so he rightly calls Jesus Lord, and those go together. Lord is the disciple's word. "First, let me go and bury my father." I took years to understand this text. I think I understand it now, partly. Because I used to think what perhaps you think. God, that seems... go and bury your father. You'd think Jesus would want you to do that. I mean, if you were here and your dad died, and you want to go and bury him, and Jesus said, "Don't go," well, I'd leave Jesus behind, wouldn't you? You'd say, "Well, this bloke's not for real." I mean, he's not. That's hardly a loving thing to do. So I need to explain that verse for you in a moment. Jesus said to him, "Follow me." See, he wants to follow Jesus, but he wants to do something first. He says, "No, follow me. Let the dead bury their own dead." Would you like an explanation? You see, you make the same assumption that I always made. I made the assumption that the father was dead. Look at the text again. Once you see it, you see it. "Let me go and bury my father first." If you assume the dad's dead, you got my problem. But just for a minute, let's assume the dad is not dead. He's hale and hearty. He's 45 and he's a farmer and he lived to 90. To bury your father means, you see, this is why this is quite certain. If the father was dead, the disciple wouldn't be there talking to Jesus. He'd be home with dad. He's living in the public. So clearly what the question is saying, look, I want to follow you, Jesus, but I've got obligations at home. I want to go back, look after my father, learn the trade, keep the thing going, and when Dad dies, you got me? Then I'll come back. Like in 50 years' time. Or 20 years' time, or whatever it happens to happen. And so the key point of this is to a disciple, any of us is, and we're going to see it put much more strongly later, no. The first thing in your life can't be your father, or your mother, or your wife, or your husband, or your child, or anything. Because if those things are first, you won't actually be loving them. First has to be God. Now, God in your wife, God in your mother, God in your father, God in your... We're not making a distinction between God out there and everyone around us. It's not God lined up with a group. It's your heart has to be in the right place for you to love anybody. Your heart has to be fixed on God. If you love your mother or father better than me, you are not worthy of me. A similar way of putting it. What comes first must be discipleship to Jesus, because that's about life. And if that comes first, then everything else will have its right place in one's life. The dead, in that case, let the dead bury their own dead. People who want to live in the dark, people who don't want to be disciples of Jesus, people who don't want to find their way to the light, people who don't dare the energy of the Spirit or all of this, but want to just live this life, which goes to death eventually, and just do their business and do that, go on and do all that. If that's where your whole heart is, well, that's going nowhere. Follow Jesus. Now, following Jesus may take you back to your farm, of course, or anywhere you happen to be. It might take you, anyone interested in becoming a priest, we're running out of numbers, take you into the presbytery here. Nothing wrong with that either, unless you do it badly. So all these ways of life are all good. But the key point is following the call and the ministry of Jesus. But our point is, what does Son of Man mean? And I'm going to explain this to you. I've given you pages, which I won't look at with you now, back and front, with all the times Matthew uses it. Some, I suppose, there's 30 or 40 on that page. Just to make it easy for you to do your homework later, I'm not going to refer to that now, just let you know you've got it. I'm going to take you to the essential meaning of the expression Son of God. There are libraries written on it. They can be very confusing. I don't want to pretend that the simple answer I'm giving you is the only thing to say. But at any rate, after years of study of this subject, I think I've got the key of it, and I'll offer it to you for your thinking. And I think it might save you reading all the stuff that I've had to read to get where I am. So let's try it. What's important to study this is that the expression Son of Man, apart from once in the Acts of the Apostles where Stephen says it, and twice in the Apocalypse, is only ever found in the Gospels. You don't find it in any of the church dogmas. It wasn't a word, it wasn't an expression that went on in theology. It was too confusing, it was too Jewish, it was too locked, as I'm going to give it to you in a moment, too hard. The suffering servant idea went on, which picks the essence of it, but not the Son of Man. So it wasn't a useful term in the scriptures or anywhere else. But you'll only ever find it in the gospel, and you'll only ever find it on the lips of Jesus about himself. So I think there's a lot of reasons for saying, if we can understand this, we understand Jesus' own self-understanding. And that's a beautiful thing to get to. He seems to have called himself, no one else calls him this, he calls himself this. So we may be getting very close to the psychological understanding of the Jesus of history of who he was. If so, that's a sacred area to be in. Well, the way to find out what Son of Man means is to go back to the scriptures you'd expect, and there's a key text, and I've got it there in front of you. It's Daniel chapter 7, where in a vision we read, I watched, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient One, God, took his throne. Daniel is written at the time of the Maccabean Revolt. Daniel is written at the time when the Syrian Antiochus Epiphanes IV has come down into Jerusalem. He has put the statue of Zeus on the altar, in the sacred place, the abomination of desolation. There's been 3 years of struggle of the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees. Maccabees is the third of them, Judas, who's the hammer. That's what Maccabee means in Hebrew. There's been a revolt, a uprising, and it was successful, finally. And Daniel is encouraging the people at this time of terrible persecution and slaughter and so on to hold on to their faith. So that's not the real Daniel. This is the Daniel, the anonymous author of this book of Daniel. And in this vision, he has a vision of the last judgment, which is an important thing. It's a very intellectual book. He's writing about what really matters. So he sets the scene for the final judgment of history by God. And what's it going to be? Well, here it is. The court sat in judgment, and the books are opened. The books of good, evil, life. And as I watched, says this man in the visions of the night, I saw one like a son of man, ordinary human being, coming with the clouds of heaven. And he came to the anointed, the ancient one, and was presented before him. And to him, this is the one that he saw in the dream, was given dominion and glory and kingship, and on the text goes. Not to a king, not to a general, not to Antiochus Epiphanes the IV, not to the leading military, not to the emperors. This is just an ordinary figure, a very ordinary human figure, was given all this glory and all this honour and all this vindication by God. Well, who is this one in the dream? The dream goes on in chapter 7, and then the author unpacks it, explains it. And when he gets to this bit, this is what he says. It's verse 27 of chapter 7. Kingship, dominion, and greatness shall be given to, well, the Son of Man. Now it is to the people of the Holy Ones of the Most High. It's absolutely clear that this Son of Man, this ordinary human being person, is symbolic for the ordinary human beings around the author, the people of the Holy Ones of the Most High. The Son of Man is representative of the ordinary, downtrodden, poor, broken people who are being murdered and butchered and persecuted in this terrible, violent Syrian invasion of Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside. These are the poor. These are the mother of the Maccabees, the mother of the seven children of the Maccabees and so on. These are the heroes and the saints and the ordinary folk who believe. These are the poor in spirit. So Son of Man, and now I'll try and hold it together for you, and you can check this by your text later, always has the following elements to it. Firstly, Son of Man means one who identifies with the poor. One who identifies with the leper. Of course he embraces the leper. Jesus was himself a leper. He may have been, but let's presume we've got no evidence that he was a leper physically. He was an outsider. He was one who was edged out. In fact, he's crucified outside the city, finally. He must have felt fairly unbelonging in this crazy world, because of his sensitivity, for a start. So he was an outsider. So Jesus is identifying with, in solidarity with the poor, the broken, the humble, the persecuted, the lonely, the sick, anyone in need. That's a beautiful thing to say. But that's what Son of Man holds. But it holds a lot more than that. It's also saying that I, Jesus, and the ones with whom I identify, so it's not a class thing, but it's a spirit thing, I and those whom I identify with, we are the ones that God vindicates. God is with the poor. God hears the cry of the poor. We are the ones by whom the world is being judged, and he doesn't mean that in a heavy sense, but he just means this is what really matters. Being poor, not economically, but in heart, spirit, being gentle, being receptive of God. And so it's saying, not only do I, he's saying to this scribe who wants to join him, I'm not with the foxes and I'm not with the birds of prey. I have nowhere to lay my head. I'm called wherever I'm called, and I'm with whomever I am. I'm going wherever God sends me, into the desert or wherever. And he's saying, not only do I identify with this people, but God identifies with them, vindicates them, and in the ultimate judgment of God, they are right. And the ones who are oppressing, using their power to put down, behaving unjustly, like Antiochus, Epiphanes, the fourth, and so on, in the judgment of God, they are wrong. So it's a judgment word. And if you read through those texts, you'll find a lot of them talk about in situations where he's clearly identifying with the poor. Most of them also very clearly indicate judgment, God's judgment of the world. So that brings me to a conclusion of tonight. We've just looked at three little scenes in a way, and two really powerful images, though, of Jesus, the suffering servant and the Son of Man, and they're both very close because his suffering is identifying with the poor. Next week, we'll move on to the next verses. Thank you.